good morning. I feel like I'm at the Cana Wine Festival, you know, in the Bible, where you guys have had the good wine, you know, starting Friday night with Joe and Patty and you, and last night with Poor Boy, and now they figure you're intoxicated enough we can slip the cheap shit right by you. It's always nice to stand before one of these things and not have to enter a plea. Want to thank Dennis and Scott and Reggie and all the folks here have been real kind in making this a real nice day. You guys have a hell of a lot to be proud of. If you're a real big analyst in life, you can go to sleep, because I got through school totally unscarred by education. You know? And fortunately, you don't need a lot of that stuff here. I got sober with guys back in New York. If you said, there's a dead bird, they'd all look up. You know, that's just the way we were, you know. Half the guys I got sober with think Moby Dick is a venereal disease. So I remember asking a guy one time, I said, how do you spell Mississippi? And he looked at me, he said, you mean the river or the state? You know? And fortunately, you don't have to be packing a lot to get here. I don't know of anybody that I've ever met who got to AA on a winning streak. You know, it's just not the way it's done. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. And thank you, honey. It was one of those neighborhoods where everybody was poor, but we didn't know how poor. Sociologists called it a ghetto. We called it home. And visitors used to come in all the time to look us over so they could write term papers. And I remember they used to say, how far is it to the subway? And we'd shrug our shoulders and say, we don't know. No one's ever made it. You know? If you didn't have a padlock on it, it wasn't yours. You know, it was that kind of a neighborhood. If it was small, we'd steal it. If it was too big to steal, we'd lay down next to it and claim it. You know, that's just the way we operated. And I grew up in this environment, the youngest of seven. And my mom and dad, my mom and dad loved us all very much. And I am one of those people, I have no qualms with my parents. I have no argument with society. I have no arguments with anyone. I earned my way into AA, you know. No one did anything that pushed me here. I earned it all on my own. It's one of the few things I accomplished all by myself, you know. And my dad died when we were quite young. And he died of this disease. Now, I laugh a lot about alcoholism because to me, I live in sobriety. And sobriety to me means living life. That's basically what it means. It means living it to the hilt. And I come from a family where we're divided into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it, you know. And unfortunately for my clan, I'm the only one who's made it so far. And about 2 years ago, I went to 9 funerals in about a 7-month period. And they were all people that I knew in my family and related to me. And they died behind this disease. And Patty mentioned something the other night, which I can attest to. My sister-in-law went in the hospital in October with cirrhosis, and she died Christmas Day. And she went in weighing about 135 pounds, and when she died, she weighed about 68 pounds, and she had hemorrhaged for over a month. And as I said, she died Christmas Day, and Christmas that year of 85 was on a Wednesday, and I flew back, and we buried her. And we buried her on a Saturday, and I came back to San Diego, where I live. And I went to a New Year's Eve function sponsored by Alcoholics Anonymous. And Kathy and I enjoyed a good time there at the dance. And the next day I got a call. My brother had died in an alcoholic convulsion, New Year's Day. So we went back home and we buried him. And my nephew, who had seen his mom die 1 week and his uncle die the next week, got picked up that afternoon for drunk driving. So education alone isn't the real big thing here. You know, it just is not the big thing. Perception has a lot to do with sobriety. I've come to experience that in my own life. We tend to prejudge a lot of things here, and I've been known to do that myself. It's like the guy who has no arms or no legs, and he shows up at the house of ill repute, and the madam answers the door, and she looks at him scornfully and says, "What the hell are you doing here?" He says, "I rang the bell, didn't I?" So the... So a lot of what goes on here goes on in what I call the ether, meaning simply that this is a spiritual program. And once you begin to understand the spirituality of this program, you are relieved of logic. You no longer have to explain anything to anyone, because there is no explanation. And you don't have to know anything. And you can get to be a good sponsor. In New York, they used to send them to a sponsor school, I'm sure, in the Bronx somewhere. Because my sponsor knew everything. I got here in July of 1970. And somehow they knew I was a newcomer. I went into a meeting. I was wearing a blue wool suit in New York with a vest and a tie. And I was in what they call the hard time meeting. And somehow everybody else was dressed a little bit more casual. And I perspired rather heavily at that meeting. It was muggy in July, and I was wearing this wool suit. And somehow those people just picked up, hey, this is a newcomer, you know? And they came over to me, and they talked to me, and they said a lot of things which made no sense to me. But the message underneath was, come back. Come back. And I did. And when I got here, I was living with my mom in a senior citizen place. And I was the only one under 80, I think, in this place. Everybody else was huffing around with oxygen and walkers. And there I was. I was sleeping on a cot in my mom's living room. And my wife had started to process divorce. And she had taken my two sons, who I love very much, and she moved out of state. And I was going to jail again. And I just didn't seem to have a lot of answers left. Things were just not going my way. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, keep coming back, it was encouraging to me. It was real encouraging. And I don't know how you folks do it here, but I got a sponsor right away, not by choice. This guy just said, you get over to my house tomorrow. And the way he said it was kind of cold. And I started showing up at his house every day. I was unemployable at the time because I had started a profession whereby I found things before you officially lost them. And I was thinking about changing trades. And he would have me come to his house every day around 3:30, and he had me do some real menial task, like take out the garbage or run to the store and get some food or whatever it happened to be. But the deal was, he knew I was hanging loose without any connection to anything at the time. And after I would do this menial task, he'd say, well, it's almost supper time. Why don't you hang out here and grab something to eat? And I began to understand what I've heard people talk about many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is this love that just keeps coming at you. You know, there's a lot of folks that have trouble with the spiritual part of this program, or the program, because it's all spiritual. And there's no need to have trouble with it, because the big book goes to great lengths to say God as you understand him. So if you get here and you believe you're an atheist or an agnostic or Hindu, whatever you happen to be, that's God as you understand him. The guys who wrote these books were not only real spiritual people, but they were street smart. They knew what they were going to be dealing with. I mean, you read this big book. I call it my owner's manual. See, I never had an owner's manual. Now I have an owner's manual. You know, a problem comes up, I check the owner's manual. And the deal is that these guys wrote the book so that when you come in, if you're in this hall today, for example, and you say you're an alcoholic forever. There's no way of changing this thing around. You're an alcoholic forever. And if you come in and you're sitting here and you say, hey, I'm not an alcoholic, they've made denial the first symptom of the disease. So if you're here, you belong, you know. You didn't get here by accident. And I began, after I was here a year, in fact, some of you may or may not know that Bill Wilson died in January of 71, and I was only sober about 6 months at the time. And when he died, they broke his anonymity, which was planned all over the papers in New York. He was not only the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he had been very successful as a broker on Wall Street. And they had his name and his picture in the paper. And I remember, to show you where I was at after 6 months, I called my sponsor and I said, "Isn't this some shit?" I said, "I finally found something that works, and now the guy who started it died." And I thought that was the end of it. You know, I thought, you know, it was like the president of a company. When he died, it was all over. And my sponsor, who was real sharp, real heavy guy, he said, "Well, show up tonight at the meeting. I think we're going to go on for a while, you know?" And no matter what I told my sponsor, he thought it was good. I'd go to him and say, "I'm going to jail." He said, "Good." "My family's gone." "Good." "I'm not doing good health-wise." "Good, good, good." "I'm unemployable." "Good, good." You know, I was scared to talk to the guy. I figured if he's the leader, he's real sick, you know? And he always had the same pat answers regardless what I was complaining about. He'd say, "Go to a meeting." And in New York, everybody, you know, out here, I guess they call them pigeons and stuff. We used to call them slobs, you know? And they used to call me on the phone and say, "Pick up this slob and take him to a meeting." And I'd say to him, "Wait a second, I want to talk to you about some things that are going on in my life." He'd say, "See you at the meeting." So I'd get on the subway and I'd go to the hell holes of this world. I mean, Brooklyn may not be the end of the world, but you can see it from there, you know? And the deal is that we used to just pick these guys up and take them to meetings. Now, I know what the big book says in writing. You know, it says as a result of these steps, we have this spiritual awakening, and then we go do this 12 step. Well, when we got sober in 1970, it was a deal where they just send you to pick people up. You weren't supposed to deliver any message. You were just supposed to deliver the slob. You know, pick him up here, take him to a meeting, and then take him home. Try not to confuse him by talking to him. You know? And learn those initial sponsor reactions, like, "Hmm." You know? So that's what I did a lot of. "Hmm." And we'd haul people all over the place. And I remember one night I had it with my sponsor. And I called him and I said, "You know, every time I call you to talk about something that's real sensitive to me, you make rather light of it." And I proceeded to tell him all the times he had failed me. And he listened very patiently. He was a good listener. And then I proceeded to tell him how badly life had treated me. And was treating me. Even though I was trying to do this wonderful thing, get sober. And when I got all done, he said, "You know, Ken, God may be with you. You may get lucky tonight and die." And he hung up. And I really realized then for the first time the depth of his sensitivity. You know? And so I came into this thing and got terribly involved. And as I said, I came from an alcoholic family. And to this day, the only time anybody in my family refuses to drink is if they misunderstand the question. You know, that's just the way it is. And I began doing some of the rudimentary things that they talk about here. The very basic things. And then the next thing you know, we started doing this book. And we didn't do it in the first year. I'm not saying any of this is right or wrong, but I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And we didn't do it in the first year. And finally, we got into the book. And my sponsor used to tell me to read those parts of the book that he knew would attract me. And the parts of the book that attracted me were the spiritual things that relieved me of the bondage of knowledge. You know? And he used to read and underline and have me read things like, "We would be rocketed into the fourth dimension." You know? That's where we're going to be rocketed. If you're here today and you haven't been on the rocket, hang out. You know? And we'll develop a sixth sense. We'll begin to know things without knowing them. Gets kind of mystical. And then we will suddenly realize. That has nothing to do with knowledge, when you suddenly realize. Truth comes all at once. It doesn't come on the installment plan. You know, either you know the truth or you don't know the truth. And when I got here, I didn't know the truth. I made it up. I made it up as I went along to fit the occasion. And he told me, you will know the truth and it will set you free. And then he began to lead me towards these promises. And one of the promises that I really latched on to is, you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. Now, if you look up the word intuitively, which I did because I'm unscarred by education, it says you will bypass the thought process. That's what intuitive means. You know, when Bambi's in the woods and there's hunters and it's that season, whatever season it is, Bambi does not go through a big mental thing. He doesn't say, well, I wonder if it's hunting season. I wonder if this bozo has a gun. I wonder if he can use it. Bambi just boogies, you know? That's intuitive thinking. And that's what we come to find out here. We get into this spiritual part of the program where we're relieved of all logic. You don't have to figure anything out. It's already figured out. And I don't know about you folks, but when I got here, I was a stranger to myself. I identified Ken with everything that was out there and not with anything that was in here. I was a father, I was a husband, I was all these things, but I was nothing. And I had to manufacture who I was because I didn't know who I was. And the deal was, is you guys taught me that meaning of love, which is, love is the process whereby we lead you gently back to yourself. And I began to understand who I was. And I no longer had to get something out there because I was beginning to develop something in here. And if you're in this room today, there are some basic things that I can tell you that apply to all of us, whether you like it or not, you know, whether you believe it or not. And one of these things is that God is love. And it's love that's continuous. And the only reason I never experienced God's love was my problem, not his problem. He was there all the time. And the other thing is that if you come here and you work this program, you will begin to realize for the first time that you don't have to become anything. You're already enough. Just the way you are, you're already enough. Now, that doesn't mean you can't change, but it does mean you don't have to gain something out there in order to be something in here. And that's a big lesson for alcoholics to learn. We're always projecting out into the future. We always want to live in the there and then, and we really live in the here and now. There is no there and then, because when we get to there and then, it's here and now. You know, it gets real simple. I'm reminded of the guy who went to Vegas, and he saw this beautiful woman. And he said he'd like to spend the evening with her in bed. And she said, no chance. And he said, I'll give you $10,000. And within minutes, they were upstairs in a room nude in the bed. And she said, kiss me on the lips. And he did. And he said, I don't know. She said, well, then kiss me on the neck. And he did. And he said, I don't know. And finally, she looked at him and said, kiss me on the breast. And he did. And he said, I don't know. And she said, what don't you know? He said, I don't know where I'm going to get the 10 grand. See? You see, that's alcoholic thinking. Right in the middle of a good thing, and he's projecting the problem. My definition of an alcoholic is anyone who can take a solution and turn it into a problem. And my second definition is anyone who can use up a year's supply of anything in 3 weeks. You know, the logo for this program should be excess is not enough. And any time you think, in quotes, that we're operating with standard gear, as far as the thinking mechanism, go and read the second tradition. Read the second tradition in the long form and then read it in the short form. And what you will discover is that the short form is twice as long as the long form. That's alcoholic thinking. See? And that's the way we are. You know, we have that kind of a mind. When we go to a wake, we want to be the corpse. When we go to a wedding, we want to be the bride. And in between, we just want to be loved. You know, and unnoticed but loved. And it takes a lot of unlearning here to get to where you want to go. I am of the firm belief, and you may not like this, but everyone in this room has had a spiritual experience. And I go to meetings and I listen to people share. And I listen to people share. And I listen to people share. And every speaker I have ever heard, whether it's in my own group, someone else, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Brooklyn, doesn't make any difference. We all go along and we tell this horrendous prologue of things we did. And then we get to a sentence that everyone says, and that is, something happened. Poor boy last night said it, something happened when he was out at that hickory stump. Something always happens. And that something happening is God's intervention. That's a spiritual experience. And if it's understandable if you don't know, because you didn't even know you're an alcoholic. So how the hell can we expect you to know you had a spiritual experience? But you look at alcoholics, they're going downhill 100 miles an hour in one direction negatively, and then suddenly they say, whoop, that's it, I'm going to a meeting, I'm going to get squared away. You know? And they say, nothing happened. Well, what happened was God intervened. And the gift, as I perceive the gift in my sobriety, is the gift of surrender. I never knew how to surrender. I never knew how to let go. I would be involved in things and the wheels would fall off and I'd tie them back on. And my logo was, I'll make this bitch run, you know? I'll do it. I'll do it. And when I got here, I at first thought I was going to have to learn a whole lot of stuff. And that has not been my experience. My experience has been I've had to unlearn a whole lot of stuff. We have to let go of our old ideas or the result is nil. I heard a guy in New York share one time about monkeys in Borneo. And he said when he was in Borneo, he saw natives catch monkeys who were very safe in the trees. And the way the natives caught them was they took these bamboo shoots and they carved them down into a little trap, actually a cage. And they put a banana in it and they put it on the beach. And the monkeys, who were very safe in the trees, would come down out of the trees. They would be attracted to the banana. They would slide their hand in. They would grab the banana. And once they made a fist, they couldn't get their hand out. And the natives would just walk up behind them and beat the hell out of them. Alcoholics can relate to that. See? We all have a banana that we hold on to. And the natives have been going to family fitness, you know. They've been getting stronger and meaner. And the people in the program say, let go. And we look in wonderment and say, who, me? You know? And after you're here 10 years, you work two cages, you know. It's no longer a case of if that's your banana, it's monogrammed. You know, that's my banana, you know. And that's the mind we work with. And we read in the book all these great things about what will come to pass, that the greatest days of our life are ahead, number one. That God could and would if he was sought. We don't have to find him. We just have to seek him. It's a real simple step. And people get into arguments about nothing. And we have skirmishes on the frontier when really the battle should take place within. The three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, I've been thinking. See? Because you know whatever comes next is going to be beautiful, you know. I've never listened to an alcoholic yet who had a problem who didn't start with, I've been thinking. And the people who wrote this book knew what kind of minds they were going to be dealing with. That's why they have a chapter. It says, into action. You know, it doesn't say into thinking, into analyzing, into evaluating, into equating. It's into action. Go and do it. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. I love life. If there was any way... If there's any way I could be happier, you tell me and I'll try it. You know, when my alarm clock goes off in the morning, I get out of bed. I jump up. I may be unscarred by education, but I can read. 99% of the people who died last year in this country died laying down. Get up, you know. Get up. Out of there, you know. Don't be a fool. If he made a mistake, let him live with it, you know. I get up. And then the first thing I do when I get up is, you know, I hear people say, I wake up and there's a committee and there's this and that. I go have coffee, see. First things first in my life. I have coffee. I don't read the big book all day. I don't make 8,000 calls. I know there's something out there waiting to be screwed up, and I can't wait to get at it, you know? The nicest part about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you will come to find there's a lot of paradoxes here. And one of the paradoxes that I have found is nothing so much fails as success. And nothing so much succeeds here as failure. Think about it. When I got here, I had been trying real hard to be a success, not knowing what the rules were, making them up as I go along. That's why life is different than school. In school, they give you a lesson, and then when you're done with the lesson, they give you a test. In life, they give you the test, you figure out the lesson. See, it's a whole different deal. That's why the guys in my neighborhood were against education. They were all for experience. Because we had a little slogan in the streets that went, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the guy who has the experience will end up with the money. And the guy who had the money will end up with an experience. See? So people told me, go get experience. You know, be totally unscarred by education. You know, people go off to college and get a BS degree. We all know what that is. Then they get an MS, more of the same. Then they end up with a PhD, piled higher and deeper. College teaches you everything except how to make a living, you know? And I watch people who become vested in their education. Now, I'm not against anybody knowing anything, because I stop fighting everyone and everything. But you see, what I have found out here is that the things that make Ken work and the things that give me the greatest satisfaction are those things that evolve from my heart, not from my head. I am into pursuing my longings today and not pursuing my ambition. Ambition can give me a lot of technical answers, but it doesn't give me those things in life that I enjoy. It doesn't give me love. It doesn't give me bliss. It doesn't give me God. To pursue material things, I have to speed up. I'm speaking about myself. You may be different. But to pursue material things, I had to speed up. And the more I sped up, the further I got away from spiritual things that came to me when I was quiet. My sponsor gave me a Bible when I was about 6 years sober. And you don't have to read the Bible, the original big book, he used to call it. And we don't endorse any religion here, but he said, read it. See what you get out of it. And I don't know what you believe about Christ, and I don't care. I don't care. But I know that man loved losers. He didn't hang out with any winners. He loved losers. And my sponsor said, the part you ought to like the best is the only one he promised heaven was some thief. And he highlighted that in my book. Someone gave him a highlighter one time. So he highlighted what he thought I should read. But the deal is that all the masters that came and all the prophets that came, they said the same thing. They said the same thing. They preached love and they preached forgiveness and they preached just what our big book says. And that is living happy, joyous, and free. We absolutely insist on enjoying ourselves. And that's what we should do. Life is a joke. And alcoholics are the punchline. I mean, this is, if you don't understand that yet, hang out here, you know? Hang out here. God's got a good sense of humor. He wants us to laugh. I mean, look at the way he made us. Man gets his sexual peak at 18 to 20, woman from 39 to 45. I love it. You know?
He knew what he was doing.
He said, hey, live with this. You know? I live in California, Southern California, where we don't look for Miss Right. We look for Miss Right Now, you know? Like... Because we understand that life is to be lived, and it's to be enjoyed, and it's not to be figured out. You will go totally crazy trying to figure life out, because there's no logic to it. God already has it figured out. Our job is just to live it. That's why I don't know about you folks, but when I took the third step, I didn't know what I was getting into. I really didn't know what I was getting into. It didn't take me but 10 years, because I'm a quick learner, to realize what I was getting into. I went through a period in my life, as I mentioned when I got here, my wife and I were separated. And we were separated the first 14 months of my sobriety. And then we got back together. And we had a good run for about 10 years. And in all, we were married 22 years. And I came home one day and she was gone, in sobriety. I was sober about 10 or 11 years. And she was gone. And a month later, she announced she was marrying someone else, which was very good for my ego. I mean, you talk about humility. It took her so long to replace me. And I called my sponsor, and you know what he said? Good, 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 good. And I went into court, and I wasn't sure of anything but except one thing, and that is I was going to get custody of me. And I wanted to be the best me I could be. And as it turned out, I have two sons, and they both wanted to stay with me. And we had a real special relationship that developed. They were older, but we had a real special relationship that developed. And once again, I was taught about love, because in talking to my sponsor about it, he said, if you love someone, you want them to be happy. You want them to be happy. And if they are happy being someplace else, then wish them well and let them go. And that was real tough. You know, it's nice to talk about this shit, philosophically. It's when you get down to paying your dues, when someone says, okay, remember that shit you had out? We're calling it in. And you have to do this stuff. But what I learned then was something I had learned in alcoholics much, much earlier. And that is that I can stay sober and happy and free regardless of what's going on around me. That's just the way it is. I see people that feel they have to do this and they have to do that. And I watch people running around. And it's like changing deck chairs on the Titanic, you know? I want to be over here and do this, and I want to be there and do that. They get a good view, but they're going down. And people confuse movement with accomplishment. And in that little book that I had been given in addition to my big book, which is my owner's manual, there was a line in there that rung true, and it said, be still and know that I am God. And for an alcoholic to be still is a death-defying act. Somehow we feel we should always be doing something. Being still means getting to that place that they talk about in the 11th step. And that is seeking God through prayer and meditation. Now, I don't know how you guys meditate, but I have reached the point in my meditation where meditation to me is getting my head totally still so that I can hear what the Master has to say. And I don't solve a problem, I solve all the problems. Because I know that this force is there, and this force will see me through. And I don't have to figure out diddle. You know, it doesn't work that way. So I began doing some things that were entirely different with my life. I had my boys, and they helped me grow up. And then my son said, Dad, you ought to start dating. And I said, the last time I asked someone out, Eisenhower was president. I said, you guys don't even know who the hell Eisenhower is. See, I got married real young in New York. We weren't as informed as people are today. Every guy that I know proposed the same way. You're what? You know, that's just the way it was, you know. We weren't very informed. We were just very quick, you know. And the deal was, I remember having to do things in sobriety that I didn't think I'd ever have to do again. And that is starting to go out. And I remember the first date. It was a year after I was divorced, just about. And the deal was, this gal that I had known in the program said, "Why don't you come over for dinner?" She had been asking me for dinner for a long time. Well, I finally said yes. And I showed up the only way I knew how to date. I had a box of candy and a bouquet of flowers in Southern California. And this gal who was sober opened the door and she looked and she said, "God bless you." She said, "You're Ricky Nelson in the John Travolta world." And I began to have to do things in sobriety, as I said, that I didn't think I'd do. And for some reason, I had this little business. And while I was married, I just got along in this little business. And then I changed businesses. And I started doing something a lot different. And people said, "You're crazy." Just like when I left New York to go to California, they said, "You're crazy. You don't know anybody out there." And I arrived in California in 74, and they were having a lot of unemployment in San Diego. It was about 12%. And I arrived there one day and got a job the next day. And I didn't have that job when I went there. And then 10 years later, the guy who hired me asked me to be his sponsor. He's in the program now. You know, so life is real funny. It goes on all the time. But I began to do things, this new business. And everything just seemed to come together. No matter what I did, it worked. I remember I had an efficiency expert come into my office one day. And he said, his pitch was, "If you listen to me and let me follow you around for a month, I'll be able to increase your productivity at least 40%, maybe even 50%. I said, "Wow, that's exciting." He said, "Now let's start off." He said, "Where do you get your clients?" I said, "From God." He said, "Can you run with that a little bit?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I go out and do this stuff that's totally unrelated to my business. And while I'm out doing it, I come back and God's been prospecting. And my business just keeps flourishing, getting bigger and bigger all the time. And I'm doing less and less. In fact, it got to the point where I only went to the office 3 days a week. Then I went in one day to do payroll. Some of the people who worked for me said, "Ken, if you stayed out altogether, we could probably double this business." And that's the way it started to go. Everything just was good. And this thing works not only in our own little tiny lives, but as we try to expand our lives. In 1983, I decided I wanted to do something. I had reached a saturation point with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to meetings. I was sponsoring about 75 people. I was doing all that stuff. But I felt there was a need to do something else, and I didn't know what it was, and I prayed about it. And what happened was, I decided I was going to volunteer in hospice. So I went to work in the hospice program in San Diego, where they work with terminally ill people. And they don't take you into the hospice program until you have been diagnosed 6 months or less, because it's not that many people that they have to work with you. So I went through the training program, and I let my business go, and I just started doing these other things. So I get in the hospice program, and the very first guy they send me out to lived out in a town called Lakeside, which is on the outskirts of San Diego. And I went out there, and the whole process of this hospice program, very much like Alcoholics Anonymous, is to be there, to love, to listen, and not to evaluate and critique. And so I showed up, and I told this guy, I said, "You know, he was real angry. He was real angry. He had cancer, and he was going to die in about 3 to 6 months," they said. And I said to him, "Well, you know, why don't you share some of that anger with me?" I said, "I've never done this before. In fact, you're the first person I've worked with, so I'm not real experienced at this, but I'm willing to help you in any way I can." And he said, "Ken, if I share it with you, you won't understand." And I said, "Well, give me a shot." He said, "You won't understand." I said, "Give me a shot." He said, "Okay. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, and I'm 39 years sober. He said, and I used to go to the meetings at the Hole in the Ground up in L.A., and I should be getting a 39-year cake, and I can't get out to get my cake because I'm too weak. He said, by the time afternoon comes, I'm just too weak to go to meetings in the evening. So at that time, they had him on liquid morphine, and he just drank that thing whenever he felt the pain. And so I said to him, you load up on that shit, and I'm going to take you to a noontime meeting and give you a cake. So he loaded up, and off we went, and I gave him a cake at noontime at a place in Lemon Grove, California. And he celebrated 39 years, and he got up to the podium, and he shared about carrying the message. Never mentioned where he was at, never mentioned the fact that his sand was running out pretty fast. And he gave about a 2 or 3 minute pitch and became totally exhausted and sat down. Well, that guy lived another whole year. And I got to work with him through that whole year. And I have a lot of guys, as I say, they say I'm their sponsor, whatever that means. And they call me on the phone, and they're always whining. Things like, Ken, she's leaving, you know. Ken, I can't make it, you know. Ken, I lost my job. So I'd say, look, I have plenty of time to spend with you. But first, we got to go see Stanley. I got a commitment to him. So they'd come to my house, and I'd haul them over to see Stanley. And Stanley was there by that time with tubes up his nose and in his arms, and he weighed nothing. And he'd be smiling and telling them, boy, you're lucky. You got another day of sobriety. And then we'd leave there, and I'd say, now, what's your problem? And somehow their problem had dissipated. And what I have to remind myself constantly in Alcoholics Anonymous is that when you bring two people together, a miracle happens. It doesn't make any difference whether you observe it or know it, a miracle happens. And a miracle happens every time two alcoholics meet. We have a language all our own. That's why the newcomers have a tough time sometimes. They come in and they don't understand the language. They don't understand sometimes that when a guy is talking about his boat, he's really worried about his sobriety, or he's worried about his job, but he doesn't talk about that. You know, it's like when a 5-year-old paints a picture of a duck in school and brings it home, and the mother's real proud and puts it up on the refrigerator. Every adult that walks by says to the child, what's that? And the child looks very proudly and says, that's a duck. Adults don't understand. But another 5-year-old walks by and says, hey, nice duck. See, we communicate differently. And that's what makes this program work, is that this stuff is going on all the time, whether we understand it or we don't understand it. You're better off most of the time if you don't understand it. And as I started to say about that third step, a lot of times I hear people share and they say things like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. And I had that problem. When I was growing up, I just knew that I wanted to be something important when I grew up. Now that I've gotten grown up, I wish I'd been more specific. But the deal was is that when I took that third step, I gave up my life. See, my life as Ken had it is done. I no longer have my life. I have what I'm supposed to be doing on a daily basis. And what I perceive today to be my life is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous wherever I can, whenever I can, and to do it, as Patty and some of the others shared, by example and by being happy with your sobriety. You know, there are some people, if they're happy, they ought to tell their face, you know? I've been here 15 years, you know? And you have to learn to be grateful for what you do have. Because it's always enough. It's always enough. I remember sitting at a meeting one time, and a guy got a 4-year cake, and he was one of those happy people. And he said, I'm 4 years sober, and tonight I'm sleeping in my car. And I had a newcomer with me, and he said, I wish I had a car. You know? And the deal is that you have to become appreciative of what you have. And what you have to learn here, and it's slow learning, is that other people's experiences may be different from your own. My experiences may be different from yours. That's why we need to hear a lot of people share. That's why sometimes speakers say things like there's one person out there, or there's two people, whatever it is that we've got to hear a lot of people share so that we can understand. You mentioned yesterday that sometimes a guy will almost slap you in the face because he'll say something like, I went to a meeting last night and heard this speaker say this, and you've been saying it to him for a year. You know, but suddenly he was ready to hear it. And it's all new to him. And you have to also learn that the problem for one is the solution to another. I've sat with guys in the morning, one guy in particular, and he looked me right in the eye, and as serious as he could be, he said, Ken, if my wife leaves, I can't stay sober. And he meant that at that time. That was where he was at. That afternoon, I sat with another guy who said, that bitch stays, I'm done, you know? So, you have to get to that point where you understand that stuff. And you have to learn to be a good listener in AA. And you have to realize that what the person is going to end up saying may be not what they're saying up front. It's like the guy who's 87 years old who goes to the sperm bank. And he says to the nurse, I want to make a deposit. She said, sir, you're 87 years old. He said, I want to make a deposit. So she said, okay, here's a jar. Go down to that room, and when you fill it up, bring it back. Well, a half hour goes by, and he doesn't come back. So she walks down the hall, and she knocks on the door, and she hears this gravel voice say, come in. And so she goes in, and this man is sitting in the corner, totally disheveled. And he looks at her, and he said, ma'am, he said, I've used my right hand. He said, I've used my left hand. He said, I even banged it off the wall. He said, I can't get the lid off this jar. So you have to listen all the way to the end. See? Because a lot of times we want to jump in with the solution and we haven't even heard the problem. And that takes time. That takes time. Listening to an alcoholic think something through is a miracle. Is a miracle. Because you watch them, it's like taking a dog for a walk. You know, the master goes out with the dog, he walks one block. He walks down to the inn, he comes back. That's not the way the dog goes. The dog goes down every alley, sniffs around every can. He's off and running. He hits every spot he can. He comes back totally exhausted. And that's the way it is when you're working with someone. They got to go down every alley because they're never going to believe you when you say, you don't have to do that. Because, see, their truth is not their truth until they experience it. I can't give you my truth. I can share it with you, but I can't give it to you. You have to discover your own truth. If we could give it to you, we'd just issue stuff at the door, skip the meetings, and close shop. But that's not the way it is. You've got to come here, and you've got to be where the game of life is played out. You've got to be at meetings if you're an alcoholic. I'm always impressed with the fact that some people come, and they stay 20 years or 25 years, and then they decide they had enough. And they want to go do something else. And we hear some terrible tales about people like that in Southern California. I'm sure it doesn't happen in Nebraska. But people who suddenly think that they don't have to be involved anymore. It's not like they want to go drink. It's just the fact that, well, I've heard everything. And once you start thinking you've heard everything, you have. Because you're not willing to listen anymore. You know? And I'm impressed with the fact that you have so many people that seem to have sobriety between like 4 and 5 years, and 3 years and 2 years here, who are so involved in your program. And that's the way it should be. And that's the way it should be. I'm always impressed with the fact that the newcomers come here thinking us old timers have worked something out. Like we know it all. You know? I remember one time saying to my sponsor, how do you know when you're really sober? How do you know that? When you're really sober. Not when you think you're sober, when you're really sober. And he said, Ken, when someone says asshole and you don't look up, you know, then you know you're really sober. And what you find out here, and this stuff comes very slowly, is that the answers that we need to work out the problems of our lives are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't have a book, get a book. And whatever you do, read it yourself. Don't let someone else interpret it for you. Because they're liable to see stuff in there that was never printed. You know? Buy your own copy. Read it. And if you can't read, it's on tape. Get a tape of it. But listen to the words and then get on with working the program. And the program here is very simple. You take the steps. And in taking the steps, you begin to find out that you are and always were enough. But you never knew that. You don't have to become something else. And what you also begin to realize is that God is working in your life whether you realize it or not. God didn't put you here to give you a rough time. He put you here to enjoy this stuff. He gave you sobriety to enjoy this stuff. You know, I read in that big book that my sponsor gave me about some woman who was hooking down in Cana, you know. And the people in the town they didn't like it. And so they lined her up to stone her. And for some reason in those days, only the men could throw stones. Seemed very unfair to me. And they were all getting ready to throw stones at this prostitute. And along came this little basic bozo. And he just sat there and he said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." So they all took a fourth and a fifth step. You know? And they put down the rock. And they just slid away. And all that guy said was, "Go and sin no more." He didn't say, "You're going to end up in hell, bitch, you're in trouble." You know, he said, "Go and sin no more." You know? And that's where the story ends. And that's where it should end. Because it makes no difference what she does. She is forgiven. And that's the nice part about this program. We come in here, most of us that I get a chance to listen to, and we've been given a lot of unsolicited gifts by other people. And we somehow feel that that's what's real. You know, and it's not real. People say things sometimes in anger. They say things sometimes in moments where they just lose their ability to think. And they say some rotten things. And we carry those scars. We carry them for a long time. And we do think that is us. And what we find out here is that not only is it not us, it never was us. And people say things innocently that we carry for life. My aunt raised us. My dad was dead, and we had 7 kids, and my mom worked in a defense plant during World War II. And my aunt used to take care of us. And my aunt one day, because I always made mayonnaise sandwiches, you know, it was easy to go and take 2 pieces of bread and throw some Hellman's mayonnaise on it. And my aunt wanted me to have something more substantial. So she said to me one day, "Mayonnaise will kill you." Now, my mind perceived that just the way she said it. And it got so I used to sneak up on the refrigerator, throw it open, and see where the hell the mayonnaise was. I had this vision of this mayonnaise jar just flying into my face. Or maybe choking me by the neck. And I carried that on. To this day, when I'm at a party, I always take the knife out of the mayonnaise. And I never turn my back on an open jar of mayonnaise. And my aunt didn't mean for me to do that. But sometimes people say things. And my sponsor, in his simple way, I remember one time I was terribly mad at someone for something they had said to me. And my sponsor said, "Does it make you that because he called you that? Any more than it would make you a penny richer if he called you a millionaire." See, so what goes on out there isn't important. I believe alcoholics develop this sixth sense, and I believe we're rocketed into that fourth dimension, and I believe we intuitively know, and I believe we suddenly realize, because at some point we come to that place where we realize that the battle that goes on is always within us. We sometimes perceive it to be outside, but it's always within us. That's why we have so much empathy for other people, because we know everyone we meet is fighting a battle. Whether we see it or not, they're fighting a battle, whether they're in AA or not in AA. If you think it's alcoholics that have all the screwy thinking, watch the news. I watched those Iran-Contra hearings. I mean, I loved it. I loved it. I'm not politically inclined one way or the other, but I loved watching those hearings because it told me that not all the sick people are showing up at meetings. Here was a guy who was sitting there in his full military regalia, and they would say things, from the southern senator would say to him, "Sir, did you lie last year?" And he'd go, "Mm-hmm, I lied last year." "Sir, did you lie last month?" "Mm-hmm, I lied last month." "Sir, are you sorry you lied?" "Mm-mm, I'm not sorry I lied." "Mm-mm. Sir, are you telling the truth today?" "Sure." "Thank you for being so candid." We go through life scratching shit that just don't itch. You know? And trying to get an alcoholic to be 100% honest is about as useless as hubcaps on a tractor. You know, it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. So what we have to do is come to meetings. And we have to be real tolerable of one another. And we have to love. And we have to find out here that getting sober and finding God is one step. It's one step. It's a quantum leap from ego to egolessness. If you could go from ego to egolessness, you're home free. It's our egos that keep us in prison. We want to project this image. And we want to look good. Looking good is more important than feeling good. And really what we have to do is become human beings. And I've learned that for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was always a human doing. And now I'm a human being. And it's hard to become a human being. People think you're just born that way. When a rhinoceros is born, he's already reached the quintessence of rhinocerosity. But when a human being is born, he's just put on the path. And you have to experience life. That's why we share our experience, strength, and hope. We don't share opinions, hopefully. Opinions don't mean jack shit. You know, I don't care what you think. I want to know what you've experienced. What you think isn't going to keep me sober. And I love people to get up and share things and tell me things about themselves so I better understand them. And that's what we do here. We get so we can see right through one another and we still enjoy the view. You know, that's what happens here. There, people that try to keep secrets stay sick. Find one person, share that with. That was said by several people this weekend. Find at least one person who you can get gut level honest with. When I came in, I got gut level honest with a Catholic priest who was in the program because the statute of limitations hadn't run out on some of my stuff. And I made him swear he would keep it a secret, and I did it in the confessional. And even though we weren't in a box, I said to him, I consider this my confession. And I remember I told him all these terrible things, and I went on, and I wimped, and I cried. I was just pathetic. And when I got all done, he looked at me and he said, is that it? Is that it? I said, yeah, that's it. I thought maybe I'd change his calling. And he said, let's go to dinner. And he said, but before we go, let me tell you something. That stuff is behind you. Don't carry it any further. That stuff is over. Don't bring it up again. That stuff is finished. Now get on and, you know, create some new shit. You know? That's why when that alarm goes off in the morning, I get up. I can't wait to get out there and get to it, you know? This is good. This is real, real good. And I live happy, joyous, and free. And I go wherever I want. And when I hear sirens on the freeway anymore, I know they're not for me. You know? When I first got sober, I heard a police car behind me. I pulled over and put my hands on the roof. And I'll tell you a story. That's an amazing story to me. Happens every day in AA, but it was involved me. But I went to my second meeting. And my sponsor had, who had chosen me to be his sponsoree at the first meeting, told me to get to a lot of meetings, go every day. And I had moved out of that place where I was living with my mom, and I had gotten my first place on my own. And it was not in the choicest area. And I moved in, and I had everything in boxes. I had no furniture. And my wife, when she was divorcing me, had left me a Hummel, because I used to drink out of this German Hummel. And my family had given it to us as a wedding gift. And it wasn't worth anything, but it was my prized possession, because everything else I had in my apartment at the time was orange crepes. And I used to have people come over, and when they came over, they had to sit on the floor. And as they sat on the floor, they would put one hand on the orange crepe in order to sit down, and I would say, be careful of that Hummel. That's my Hummel. And my sponsor, God love him, who knew everything about me before I even told him, came over to visit me, and he brought me some coffee. And I remember saying to him, sit down gently and don't hurt my Hummel. And he looked at me and he picked it up and he threw it off the wall. And it went in about 800 different pieces. And he looked at me and said, you don't have to worry about shit. And he was right. I could go out and leave my door open. Who wants orange crepes, you know? But he got me started with material wealth real fast. And I went to this meeting and I met a guy. And I liked this guy because he wore a suit to the meetings. And I didn't even have a Hummel. And I was there about 2 months, and I thought, well, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. And I said, would you be my sponsor, Tom? And he said, no. I said, why not? He said, I've only been here about a month ahead of you. I don't even have 90 days yet. He said, but I'll go to meetings with you like we're doing, and we'll share, and hopefully we'll stay sober together. So we did that. And about 7 months into my sobriety, the grand jury came in and said something was wrong with me, and that I was going to have to go to trial. And this would put me in a situation, because of some earlier discrepancies, that I would probably go to jail for 4 to 12 years. And I had to go to the district attorney's office, and actually I went to the assistant district attorney's office, and when I walked in, who was there but this guy that I had asked to be my sponsor? Now, that doesn't sound real big in Omaha, Nebraska. But in New York, in the greater metropolitan area, there's about 12 million people. And there are about 40 to 60 assistant prosecutors. And out of those 12 million and those 40 to 60, the guy I asked to be my sponsor was the guy who was involved in my case. And he looked at me and he said, as he went through the papers, I didn't know you did this. And I said, well, I sure as hell didn't know you did this, you know? And so we worked a deal out where I didn't have to go to jail. And I made restitution for that situation, financial restitution, for about 8.5 years into my sobriety. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because there wasn't a month that went by in those first 8.5 years when I was writing that check that I wasn't reminded of what it was like. And I was also reminded of what it was like now. And when I was about 10 years old, I had a teacher who took us out to the Statue of Liberty. And that teacher was a pretty sharp old gal, because she knew as sixth graders we were kind of intimidated by the size of this thing. And at that time it was on what they called Bedloe's Island. Now they've renamed it Liberty Island. But the Statue of Liberty is very cold and damp inside, and it's very ill-lit. Or it used to be ill-lit. Now they've fixed it up. And as we were going through there, she knew that we might be afraid and intimidated by it, so she had us hold hands. So you had hand in hand with somebody who was in front of you, and you had hand in hand with somebody who was behind you, and you went through that Statue of Liberty. And no matter how terrified or afraid you were, you could hear some laughter of kids out ahead, and you could hear some laughter of kids behind, and you knew somehow physically you were locked in. You were okay. And to go back, to give up, meant you had to go past everyone who was behind you and holding on. And to me, that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous has worked all my life. I got here and I put one hand in God and one hand in another alcoholic, and I don't have any hands to pick up a drink. God bless you.